You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of October 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Marcus Hippie.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's news agenda with Alessio Batalano. Alessio, what do you have for us today?
Today, we know that Prime Minister Abe won't tolerate the use of force to change regional status quo, while the Chinese were happy to announce that their submarine fleet is coming to an age. And finally, a little bit of trouble in Afghanistan with a newly set up academy for the officer corps.
More from Alessio a little later. Also coming up in today's program, Social Democrats lead the Czech election, but there's no clear winner. We'll unpick this weekend's election results.
And we'll be on the line with our Milan correspondent, who will tell us all about Berlusconi's latest political stunt, as well as why Italy may soon have more chefs than lawyers.
Plus, we'll find out what it's like to be a pop star if you're from the Middle East.
The popularity of this music made it that a lot of sheikhs that were the main singers of the Sufi groups in the rural areas of Egypt left their turban and started to be popular singers.
All that plus, we'll leaf through the Brazilian front pages and we'll play some music too. All to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So a very busy Monday edition of the program, but before all that, here is Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Three people have been killed and at least 11 more injured after a car ploughed into pedestrians and caught fire in Beijing's Tiananmen Square. Police say the three who died were all in the car. Those injured included tourists and police officers. The car crashed close to the main entrance of the Forbidden City, where a huge portrait of the founder of communist China, Mao Zedong, overlooks the square. Following the incident, the square was evacuated and the main road through it closed. The coalition government of the Argentine president Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner has lost some of its congressional majority in the country's midterm elections. Voters chose half of the lower house of Congress and a third of the Senate in Sunday's poll. Analysts say 7 out of 10 votes cast went against the government. The result makes it highly unlikely that Congress would pass a constitutional change to allow the president to run for a third term. Early results from Georgia's presidential election suggest a resounding victory for Georgi Margvelashvili, the personal pick of Prime Minister Budzina Ivanishvili. With under 20% of the votes counted, he was already on over 60%, with his closest rival David Mukhradze just over 20%. Mr. Mukhradze has already conceded defeat and congratulated his opponent. But another of the candidates, Nino Bourjanadze, said she didn't believe the exit polls and was not ready to accept the outcome until many more results are in.
Polls are not working in Georgia. I know this quite well. And exit polls are the same as we saw before. We are counting right now the votes on the places. I know that people are very active and we had real support. And I'm sure that the numbers which will come will be absolutely different than that exit polls which have been publicized.
A German newspaper said on Sunday that President Obama knew his intelligence service was eavesdropping on Angela Merkel as long ago as 2010, contradicting reports that he'd told the German Chancellor he did not know. Quoting a US intelligence worker involved in the National Security Agency operation against Merkel, Bild am Sonntag said the NSA chief, General Keith Alexander, informed the president in person in 2010. But the NSA said Mr. Alexander had never discussed any intelligence operations involving Chancellor Merkel with the president. Southern and central England are being hit by one of the most violent storms in 5 years. Winds of nearly 100 miles an hour have been coming in from the southwest, where 2,000 homes are without power. 17 flood warnings have been issued for the region, with 152 flood alerts in place across England and Wales. Some road bridges have closed, 130 flights have been cancelled at Heathrow Airport. Many rail services have also been cancelled, and Britain's rail network operator says a revised timetable is already in place on some routes. Robin Gisby from Network Rail.
A lot of work. We've got lots of staff out tonight. We've been working closely with the train operators and the weather forecasters to get an assessment of what's going to hit us in the small hours tomorrow. First landfall will be early in the morning. Unfortunately, it will come right through the south of England and through Anglia, right in the middle of the morning rush hour.
The Hollywood actor Sylvester Stallone unveiled an exhibition of his artwork at the Russian Museum in St. Petersburg on Sunday. 36 paintings created over 40 years are on display at the museum, which boasts the biggest collection of Russian art in the world. The actor behind the tough Hollywood characters of Rocky and Rambo had been concealing his passion for art for a long time, though he did show some of his works in 2009 at an art fair in Miami Beach. He says art is an important part of his life.
The visual image automatically started to inspire me to go into the verbal image for writing. So all the arts are linked. One helps the other, helps the other. So I try to combine in my paintings cinematic feeling, emotional feeling, and sometimes actually writing on the painting to combine all the different elements of communication.
Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Barney Burnham. Barney will be back in less than 30 minutes to give us more news headlines. It is 17:06 in Tokyo, 10:06 in Istanbul, 8:06 here in London. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24. Hong Kong,
Hong Kong, Zurich, London,
London. Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Via Monocle, vada a City Check.
From London,
London, London, Caracas.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London. It's time now to set the day's news agenda with the three stories we'll be keeping our eyes on throughout the day here on Monocle 24. Well, joining us today in the studio is Alessio Padolano from King's College here in London. Alessio, many thanks for joining us here on the program. Where should we begin today?
Well, today we're starting off with the news, the latest public speech by Prime Minister Shinzo Abe of Japan. As you know, this was a very busy weekend, one in which lots of things happened. We're coming at the end of a few days where the Japan-China Friendship Association met together, so we had senior officials talking to each other. But at the same time, in this China Sea, we have the usual business of an increased number of jets flying over the area. Later on yesterday, early today, there were assets from the Chinese Coast Guard getting into again the territorial waters of the Senkaku Islands, known in China as Diaotai. So Prime Minister Abe's speech is coming at the end of another event, which is very much national and domestic in Japan, the celebration of the Self-Defense Forces Day. And during the event, he announced that Japan would not tolerate the use of force for changing the status quo in the region, which is a sentence, an expression that's been using over the past few months, really, in reference to Chinese behavior, increasing assertive behavior in the East and the South China Seas.
What does that mean in practice?
Well, in practical terms, I think that it means three things, at least what we can understand from the various sort of official statements of the weekend. It certainly means that, one, Prime Minister Abe is now expanding his foreign policy agenda. He's not just talking about Abenomics. He's also saying, well, Japan now, because the neighborhood is getting tougher, Japan will stand up as one of the sort of responses to this growing assertive behavior on behalf of China. So that's the first level. At the regional level, we're looking at a country that is taking a decision. We want to be here. We're here. We are the other guy to talk to in this respect. And I think that is an important signal. And perhaps we should go back and see the sort of silence that is coming from the American side in this respect.
We haven't seen a Japanese leader behave this way in quite some time, in such a nationalistic way. You know, he wants to potentially revise the post-war pacifist constitution. We saw earlier this year Japan launched its largest battleship since World War II. Could this potentially become a sort of an arms race, in a sense, in the region?
Well, I think that this was long overdue. I think that in practical terms, there is an element of normalization of the behavior on behalf of all regional actors. So there is definitely at the narrative level, at sort of the level of communication, strategic communication, there is a clear sense that you have a much more nationalist sort of chest-pumping type of narrative.
Does that play well among the Japanese public?
I think that the Japanese public is concerned because they do see that there is on a regular basis news of North Korean erratic behavior. They notice that their jets have to be scrambled more often because of the increased military activity of the Chinese in their surrounding waters. So there is a sense that Japan should provide a response. And what I think what is happening is a prime minister that unlikely that is giving this impression, or if you want, whatever it is that he's saying, it seems it comes across much stronger because of the absence for many years of prime ministers that were taking some sort of a more clear-cut position on matters of national security.
And how will the US react to the current political competition between Japan and China?
I think this is the toughest sort of call because the Obama administration is coming at the end of a rather difficult month. The government shutdown did provide, at least in terms of image, a little bit of damage. We've seen it with all the various important meetings, APEC, ASEAN, that happened a few weeks ago. So from this point of view, they have to come up with something stronger. The problem being that both the Chinese and the Japanese, and in terms of mutual diplomatic and sort of official exchanges, there is a clear sense of tension. So how will the United States try to respond to that? Reassuring Tokyo on the one hand, but also making opening to China, that is a very difficult position they cut for themselves.
Well, let's stay with China and specifically their military when it comes to their navy. A bit of a showcase when it comes to their nuclear submarine fleet.
Absolutely. Well, there's three things to say. I mean, first of all, besides all the talk about the top-flying, very visually impressive assets like the aircraft carriers, the new drones and all other bits and pieces, the truth is that submarines do remain one of the key assets insofar as the regional security balance is concerned. Mm. And in this respect, it is important, I think, that the official Chinese communication channels are, for the first time, advertising pictures of the submarine fleet. They're saying, like, we're here. This is one of the safest components of the Chinese military, which is a sign of how the military is walking hand in hand with Chinese sort of expansion industrially, economically, etc. And there is also, they might suggest a degree of opening towards the external world, because this is, after all, one of the most sensitive components of the Chinese military arsenal. And internationally, there's always been this tension insofar as the opaque structure of the Chinese military. So this might be a response, like, well, we want to open up a little bit and tell you more about it.
And how do the Chinese submarine forces compare to the ones, say, from the United States or Russia?
This is the other thing. One of the reasons why they released this information, it's because for now the force has been around for 42 years and apparently is one of the safest in the world because never really experienced a sort of major trouble with their nuclear engines, unlike Soviet and Russian forces, or as it happened in the past with the United States. One obviously could make the opposite point, that is, well, they weren't really going there very often at sea for a long time, so that makes it easier to keep it under control. So I think, again, depending on how you put your angle, your perspective, you might get some very different messages. I don't think one should overdo it, primarily perhaps because the submarines that we're talking about is the first generation. So it's the one that are being phased out soon enough.
And finally, Alessio, let's switch our focus to Afghanistan. A growing row when it comes to the Afghanistan Sandhurst, a bit of a controversy there, all about trust, I guess you could say.
Yes, definitely. There is two different levels here of interpretation. One is the sort of political one. This was an important project for the British government, a sign of the British commitment once the troops will be withdrawn, and the fact that this happens at the very beginning. We are within the first week that the academy has opened, does raise doubts as to the viability of keeping this project together.
And now there's been bad press indeed. There's been a fatal row during the first week of this officer academy.
Yes, well, it happened in a way that it hasn't been confirmed entirely. What we know is that an Afghan soldier, one of the guards, took a computer or laptop from one of the other Afghan soldiers, and then he ended up in a bit of a quarrel with two Australian and the New Zealanders soldiers, which were shot, and eventually one of them died and the other two were injured. So altogether, and obviously this provoked a response. So we have a clear sense of tension, which definitely talks about to the lack of trust you mentioned earlier on.
Alessia Bazzalano from King's College London, thank you very much for joining us here on Midori House.
Coming up, we'll be in the Czech Republic after voters went to the polls this weekend. We'll assess the results right after this very short break.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there, and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love, generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Marcus Hippy. Now, when citizens of the Czech Republic headed to the polls over the weekend, they were supposed to bring about an end to the political instability brought about by a scandal which saw the resignation of Prime Minister Peter Nečas. Instead, as results came in, a clear victor there wasn't.
The centre-left Social Democrats won 50 seats, followed by 47 for the centrist Ano Party. The goal now is an attempt at coalition building to come up with some kind of government. Well, joining us now is Martin Ehl, foreign editor at the Prague-based daily newspaper Hospodarské noviny. Thank you and welcome to the programme, Martin. First of all, how difficult is it going to be now forming a government?
Well, it will be quite difficult because yesterday we have witnessed quite a strong power struggle inside a winning party, Social Democrats, because there is a part of Social Democrats which want to overthrow their recent leader, Mr. Sobotka, and these people are inspired by the president, Miloš Zeman, who was formerly founder of the Social Democrats, but then he went into quarrels with the party. He found his own party, which didn't succeed in the election, so now he wants to divide the Social Democrats. So even if somebody would like now to talk about the government, there is first Social Democrats as a winning party must solve their internal dispute. So everybody is not surprised because we expected this kind of development, but that it went so strongly and so early after the elections.
And Martin, I guess one of the other shocks from this past weekend's election was how many new political parties have entered parliament.
Well, the most shocking was the success of the movement called Ano 2011, which is Yes 2011, by the second richest Czech businessman, Mr. Babiš, who founded kind of a protest party, and even the polls were predicting him success. The success itself was quite remarkable because he was just 3 points behind the winners, behind the Social Democrats. So it showed the kind of a stubbornness in which Czech voters are in clash with their political parties, with their political class. And the what is most striking, because this one, this Mr. Babiš party, we can call kind of a classical populistic business-oriented party like Mr. Berlusconi in Italy, and we have seen it all around Europe. But what is more dangerous is the 7% for the movement founded by another successful businessman, which is more nationalistic, kind of proto-fascist movement like Golden Dawn in Greece, this kind of movement. So this is a very striking and dangerous development.
Can you see these parties making it to the to the government, or which parties can you actually see forming the government?
Well, now the kingmaker is Mr. Babiš, the guy from the second party from Yes 2011, because he has now in the hands any viable coalition, because without his 47 deputies, nobody would be able to form a government, either from the left or from the right. But he doesn't want to go with the left because of the ideological program way, and he doesn't want to go to with the right, which was harshly beaten, the two classical parties from the right, because for him these are the examples of bad politicians or bad political mismanagement, corrupted parties. So it's quite hard. It's kind of a joke that in the first post-election debates, everybody wanted to be in opposition. Nobody wanted to take the responsibility to govern in their first expressions. But Mr. Babiš now is the guy who will decide if he would join any of the parties to form a government. So the situation is quite unstable and unpredictable.
Martin, was this more a rejection of the country's right-wing political parties rather than an endorsement of the Social Democrats?
It was rejection not just the right-wing parties. It was rejection of the parties which were formed after 1989, after the change from communism to democracy. And it was a refusal of the style of the politics, which was connected with the nepotism, corruption, with all the bad features of post-communism. Because according to the first analysis, also a lot of voters of Social Democrats left from the Social Democrats to this Yes party. So they have grabbed the voters from all around the political scene. But yes, because the previous government was center-right, so the more beaten were center-right parties.
Martin Ehl, foreign editor at the Prague-based daily newspaper Hospodarske Noviny, thank you very much. You're listening to Midori House. The time is 17:22 in Tokyo, 12:22 in Moscow, and 8:22 here in London. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world, and joining us today is Monocle's man in Milan, Ivan Cavallo. Ivan, thank you for joining us. Welcome to the program. Shall we start with Silvio Berlusconi and what he's been up to recently?
Yeah, good morning, Marcus. Silvio Berlusconi, last Friday, brought together members of his party, and he has announced he's relaunching his old Forza Italia party, which is the one that he created. It's based on a football chant that means "Go Italy," and he's bringing that back, and he's dissolving his People of Freedom's party. And it's a curious move because some of the members of his party don't agree with him on this decision.
And it's probably not going to be very good news for Italy's right parties, but obviously I'm guessing Prime Minister Enrico Letta is quite happy about all this possible split on the right.
Yeah, indeed, Phil, because the PDL party includes, the party secretary is Angelino Alfano, which he was at one time seen as the successor to Berlusconi on the center-right. Berlusconi basically appointed him. But in this recent battle with Letta and Berlusconi having his problems with the judicial problems and his convictions in court, he was trying to bring down the Letta government. And Alfano reversed this move and decided that there were members of the party that said, look, it's not a good time to bring down the government. People are unemployed. They're looking for solutions. And to take this personal matter and try to bring down the government is not a good move. And so the so-called doves in the center-right have decided that for the moment they want to stay in the PDL. And for example, Alfano wasn't even at this meeting on Friday to agree on changing and going back to Forza Italia. So you're going to be seeing some divisions now on the center-right.
How much support does Silvio Berlusconi still have left?
That's an interesting question. You know, the polls are always saying that there are votes out there for Berlusconi, and the loyalists, that the hawks in his party say, look, he's the one that always wins the elections. He can bring millions of votes. He's the only campaigner who's charismatic. now with these judicial problems, they're wondering, well, maybe you know his daughter could come in his place if he has to serve time, if he's voted out of the Senate because he's facing an impeachment vote in the Senate. It's always revolving around this charismatic figure, whether it's him or his daughter. The center right hasn't been able in all these years to come out of his shadow, and it's a big problem, which is again rearing its head, because at the moment they're left with him and they haven't been able to bring a new generation of leaders forward.
So is it just a sense that his party, fellow party members, are just sick and tired of him and essentially want a fresh start?
Yeah, it's difficult because he's been able in this apparatus for so many years. Obviously, he has the media influence, the newspapers as well. And interestingly, recently on Italian TV, one of the editor of paper he owns was actually arguing with one of his was thought to be loyal center right politicians, and it was curious to see, you know, this infighting on the right. And of course, you know, the Letta and the people of the Democratic Party are hoping that this will go on so that they can siphon off votes and use the doves on the center right and work with them and try to get through reforms which, you know, Italy desperately needs.
And then, Ivan, you'd like to draw our attention to the mayor of Florence, centre-left mayor Matteo Renzi. What has he been up to recently?
Well, you know, everybody's looking at Matteo Renzi now as the successor, the person who's going to lead the centre-left in a government in the next election, it looks like. The funny thing is that a year ago, Matteo Renzi lost the primary to be the party secretary of the Democratic Party. But here he is now back because of the election result that we had earlier this year, which led to Pierluigi Bersani resigning because he basically lost the vote, even though he won, because of the way the electoral law and the results that came out. And Bersani resigned. You know, Letta was chosen to be the leader, but curiously, you know, Letta comes from a family that his uncle, for example, is a close confidant of Berlusconi. And people are saying that, you know, Berlusconi's been able to manage this coalition. He was the one that ended up maneuvering to have Napolitano come back as president of the Republic. Renzi is this fresh face. You know, he's only 38. He's quite young. His language is very forceful. He wants to bring, he wants to take the old generation of politicians and put them on the scrap heap. He's toned down a bit his language, but this weekend he's at a convention in Florence, and he's basically going to be knighted the winner of the primary. There's basically the other candidates have a slim chance of challenging him.
And Ivan, you mentioned the country's electoral law there. It's something that the Italian president wants lawmakers to deal with.
Yeah, Giorgio Napolitano recently said that he set a deadline for December about trying to fix this, the Porcellum, the pigsty law, which is something that dates back to a Berlusconi government putting in a law that makes it awfully complicated to win a majority in both houses of parliament, because you have to win a national consensus and then on a regional level in the Senate. And it's left us with this crazy coalition, because you have this fractious group of parties, you know, in the parliament, and to create a new law that will give Italy a clear, you know, winner first takes first past the post kind of system, because at the moment, you know, the courts are looking at maybe throwing out part of the law, the constitutional courts, and so Napolitano is saying, look, the parties need to get together and decide on a new system by December.
And Ivan, let's finish by talking about effects of the economic crisis. There's a significant number of young Italian students now who are, well, studying to become chefs or hotel managers.
Yeah, this is a sign of, you know, the difficult economic times. Obviously, you know, factory jobs have been hit quite hard in Italy during this long recession, which is, you know, now 2 years on. And a lot of people are looking at it. We can call it the sort of the master chef phenomenon, if you like. I was just like talking with Diego Della Valle of Todd's group, and he was saying it's a bit of a pity that we can't get people, young people, to become interested again in the trades and crafts and it making various goods, whether it's leather goods, shoes, bags, whatnot, and to have to make a decent living that way. Right now, a lot of people are seeing a future in hospitality, hoping that, you know, Italy's tourism sector will at least survive and grow as emerging market tourism comes, and that will grow the tourism market. Unfortunately, industries are suffering at the moment. So you're seeing sort of a 2-to-1 ratio between people going, you know, students signing up for classes, being chefs and cooks, and staying away from the technical schools.
Ivan, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Monocle's man in Milan, Ivan Carvalho, many thanks for joining us on the program.
In the next half hour of the program, we'll leaf through the Brazilian front pages and we'll meet Abd Alhai Hilmi, the equivalent of a pop star in the early 20s in Egypt.
Abd Alhamouli was the star of the century. He was the singer of the king. And this gentleman was a sort of dandy, a sort of early punk in Egypt.
But first, here's Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Phil. Three people have been killed and at least 11 more injured after a car ploughed into pedestrians and caught fire in Beijing's Tiananmen Square. Police say the three who died were all in the car. Those injured included tourists and police officers. The coalition government of Argentine President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner has lost some of its congressional majority in the country's midterm elections. Voters chose half of the lower house of Congress and a third of the Senate in Sunday's poll. Analysts say 7 out of 10 votes cast went against the government. Partial results from Georgia's presidential election suggest a resounding victory for Georgi Margvelashvili, the personal pick of Prime Minister Budzina Ivanishvili. With around 20% of the votes in, he's already well ahead of his closest rival David Bakradze, who has conceded defeat. A German newspaper said on Sunday that President Obama knew his intelligence service was eavesdropping on Angela Merkel as long ago as 2010, contradicting reports that he told the German leader he did not know. Southern and central England are being hit by one of the most violent storms in 5 years. Winds of nearly 100 miles an hour have been coming in from the southwest, where 6,000 homes are now without power, and there's been widespread transport disruption in the south of the country. The Hollywood actor Sylvester Stallone has unveiled an exhibition of his artwork at the Russian Museum in St. Petersburg. 36 paintings created over 40 years are on display at the museum, which boasts the biggest collection of Russian art in the world. There's the headlines at the bottom of the hour. Here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Barney. You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Markus Hippi and Phil Hahn. Now to the Middle East for a preview of this week's culture show. The early 20th century was a time of royal courts for shahs, sultans and sheikhs, but also a time when being a pop star was pretty similar to how it is today. Make some music, make some friends in high places, grab some headlines and hold on to them.
Well, one such was Abd Alhai Hilmi, a charming character and the toast of the region at that time. His work and an entire huge archive has been unearthed by Kamal Kassar under the auspices of the Amar Foundation. The first fruits of his labor are soon to be released with our friends Hannes Jones Records, and Rob Bound spoke to Kamal about finding such a treasure chest of musical archive from a forgotten era.
When I purchased the collection, it was a little neglected by the sons of this big collector. I quickly took it out to my place in Lebanon. And
you got your vinyl duster out.
Yeah. And I just opened that and I realized that it was unique recordings. Nobody knows about. Nobody spoke about, nobody mentioned anywhere, even in the novels that talk about that period, it's not mentioned. So it's really a hidden part of our history that I discovered there. So immediately I thought that I cannot keep that for me.
Right, so you sort of opened it up, and this is one of the things that the Amara Foundation does. It's sort of disseminating the message, isn't it? Spreading the love,
sure.
Broadly speaking, for our listeners, tell us about the sort of music that you found on these old 78s in this Egyptian collection. What sort of artists are they? What's the style of the music?
Well, those artists are that I present here, and I'm presenting since a couple of years, are the artists who had the chance to cross the 20th century, who was famous in the 19th century, and they had the chance to be recorded by the many, many record companies that rushed to Egypt to start recording.
Was Egypt the sort of hotbed of this? Was it the
Egypt
sort of...
was sort of the cultural capital of the Middle East. Cairo was the biggest city in the Middle East. And there was a big effort made by the rulers of Egypt at that time, especially starting the beginning of the 19th century, to turn Cairo into sort of very modern Istanbul.
Mm.
So they turned swamps into gardens. They made opera houses. They made kiosks for bands to play. And they funded the singers, the poets. So there was poets of the court, poets of the pashas, and singers of the big traders, big landowners. There was a fever of production of music and a fever of literature. In the middle of the 19th century, the singers, composers of that period put on a form of music. And this form was the most popular form that went until the 1930s. It was the main form of singing.
So what do we call this type of music then that was so popular until the 1930s? And what was it like? Did it have any... This was sort of the jazz age for Western music,
yes,
wasn't it?
Yes, it is. When I want to compare this music to something, I would compare it to the jazz bands.
Okay.
Because at that time, the band was mainly of five musicians.
What were they wearing? White tie?
No, they were wearing tarbush.
Yeah.
The big fez hat, and sometimes ties, sometimes they are wearing the rural long gone.
Yeah.
In fact, the popularity of this music made it that a lot of sheikhs that were the main singers of the Sufi groups in the rural areas of Egypt left their turban and started to be popular singers.
That's a pretty good story, isn't it?
Yeah, and it was a large movement towards the singing in the cities. It was really, really rich music because it involved a composer and it involved an interpreter working together to put out very good recordings.
And the result is a bit of magic. And we should talk about one of the stars of the show, who was Abid Al-Hay Hilmi. He was a fairly louche cat, right?
Yeah, he was. Abd al-Hamouli was the star of the century. He was the singer of the king. And the king sent him to the big sultan of Turkey for 1 or 2 months to sing to him. Then he started by himself being a big singer. He didn't came from a religious background as many others. He was an effendi, I mean a gentleman.
Yeah.
And this gentleman was a sort of dandy, a sort of early punk in Egypt. He used to wear fancy suits brought for him by his patrons from Paris. He was very moody. When invited to a concert, he would sit in his chair, because at that time they used to sing sitting, and he would stare to the audience. If he doesn't find a nice figure, man or woman, he would leave the concert and he wouldn't sing.
And that was Kamal Kassar there speaking to Robert Bound for this week's edition of Culture. And you can catch the full interview when the show premieres tonight at 1900 hours London time.
You're listening to Midori House. After this, we'll pay our respects to the vanishing art of letter writing.
To report on the world, you need reporters around the world. With Bureau in Hong Kong and Tokyo, New York and Toronto, Zurich and, up next, Istanbul, Monocle 24 has a growing network of editors and correspondents. In Tokyo, Fiona Wilson.
From the Tokyo office, we cover everything from politics and business to architecture and design. We might be reporting on Shinzo Abe's radical economic policies or territorial tensions in the Senkaku Islands, as well as breaking news from around the region.
In Hong Kong, Aisha Spears.
From Monocle's Hong Kong office, we take stock of much of the Asia-Pacific region. We're watching everything from Xi Jinping's changing China to the Southeast Asian economies that are fast becoming hubs for young, creative business.
In New York, Santiago Rodriguez Tarditi.
From the New York Bureau, we cover the latest in food, travel and hospitality trends while keeping an eye on the business developments and political happenings in the US and the rest of the Americas.
Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
It is 12:40 in Dubai, 8:40 here in London and 4:40 in New York. In a time where communication is often reduced to a short, snappy email or worse, a tweet, it's become necessary to remind the world of a much nobler form of interaction, the letter. Journalist and author Simon Garfield sets out to do just that in his new book, To the Letter, A Journey Through a Vanishing World.
The book takes us through the history of a bestseller. Epistolarity, as Garfield calls it, a journey from the most lyrical letters to the raunchiest ones, to some inexplicable notes like tinkety-tonky old fruit, a phrase the Queen Mother used at least once to sign off a letter to a friend. Well, I'm pleased to say that Simon Garfield joins us now in the studio to discuss his book. Thanks very much
for coming on the program. It's really nice to be here. I won't even attempt to say the word
It's tough
impossible.
Word, epistolarity.
Yeah, exactly.
Epistolarity. Well, it's a lovely book. You track the history of, I guess, letter writing going back some 500 odd years.
Oh, more. 2,000 years.
2,000.
Yeah, no, I go back all the way to the ancient Greeks and Rome and then come right up to date with emails.
Looking at the topics of those letters, when it comes to those old ones that were written thousands of years ago and the ones nowadays, have the themes remained the same?
Oddly, yes. I mean, it's a kind of, if you look at the ancient Greeks, they tend to be very, you know, their letters are all about sort of oratory, really. It's basically they could have performed their letters. But as soon as you get to the Romans, they express the sorts of emotions that we express now. And they're kind of, it's very odd. You think, okay, so the Romans in Britain, you know, 2,000 years ago, they're defending, you know, Hadrian's Wall and the north of England. And they write back to Rome and they say things like, you know, we're freezing here, bring more coats, bring more beer was quite common as well. And then women who are about to travel back to Rome or say things like, okay, so we'll be back at a certain time and can you please rearrange the cushions for our return?
And in the book, you also track, you know, there's different themes. You talk about love, you talk about the joy of letter writing, the heartbreak as well as a very big theme in there. Is there a particular focus that you really, spent most of your energy on?
Well, no, but I mean, it's a bit like songs, really. It tends to be that the letters that interest us most now, and the ones that have survived in the main, unless we're looking at business letters, are love letters, really. It's that, and also that's why people write. I think if people write now still by post, it tends to be condolence letters, thank you notes, and occasionally love letters. I mean, we don't tend to write love emails. So love is really
and a fascinating
the
part of the book, a great part of the book when you talk about Charles Schulz, of course, the creator of Charlie Brown.
Yeah, yeah, no, an amazing thing. So the classic thing with Charlie Brown was that he never ever received Valentine's or love letters of any sort. And there were lots of cartoons with him sort of almost disappearing, certainly his hand disappearing, maybe his whole body disappearing into his mailbox in the desperate search for a love letter from the, you know, the curly red-haired girl. And basically, they never arrive. And then last year, it emerges that Charles Schulz himself wrote these incredibly passionate love letters to a woman he was having an affair with, outside his marriage.
Exactly. That is something about letters. There's so much emotion in them so often. You don't get quite the same when you're writing an email to someone, even though you may have a bit of flirting going on. As you mentioned in the title of the book, To the Letter, A Journey Through a Vanishing World, it's not very good times for letters anymore.
No,
is this a lost game, or is there somehow a way of going back?
Well, I think we're in the sort of last golden age, in a way, that there are now some fantastic books, collected letters of people like Paul Cézanne and P.G. Woodhouse and Don Bacardi and Christopher Isherwood, and these have just come out. But I don't think we're going to see similar ones in, 100 and 150 years. I mean, the thought of getting collected emails is, pretty horrendous. So first of all, they'll all look the same. There won't be any kind of, physicality to them. If you download them on your, on your Kindle or other kind of reading device, goodness knows what we're going to be reading in 100 years' time. They're all going to be very flat and the same font and everything else. We do miss that. And you're quite right. As you said at the beginning, the real problem is not so much that we write emails, because that's great. Obviously, we're always going to find ways of communicating, but that we don't write in the same way. And I think that's going to be a real problem for historians to kind of try and catalogue how we lived our lives. You look through emails, they're all going to be, in the main, a link to a cat video, or I'm going to meet you there. I'm sorry, I'm going to be late, or some business, transaction. Mm.
Are you still a passionate letter writer?
Yeah, I do. Very odd, but in the last year, I've begun if I say the word intense, it sounds like it's romantic, and it isn't at all, but quite a serious correspondence with a woman on the east coast of America who I've never met, and I got her address through a slightly circuitous route. I've never met her, we've never emailed, and we just sort of exchange letters. And you do write, as I said, you do write in a different kind of way, because you keep information back for a week or two. You try and frame a letter in a certain way as well.
And when you were doing research for this book and you kind of saw all these letters and read about them, what were the most memorable ones?
Well, the one you mentioned I thought was sort of extraordinary. So I should begin by saying I think my favourite modern letter writer is Ted Hughes, who writes, as a letter that I quote at the beginning of a chapter on him, is the only one who has a chapter all to himself, where he kind of writes to his daughter at school. And it's just a letter that he wrote probably in sort of 10 minutes, just what was happening that day and that week at home. And he wrote just in the most poetical, lyrical way, as you might imagine. And then the information in that letter you can then track to a poem he wrote later. So I think he's my favourite modern poet. But I look in the book at kind of sign offs. Well, I look at sort of how you begin a letter, and lots of sort of letter writing guides, but then also how you close a letter. And obviously we say, best wishes or, things like that. And those haven't changed either for 2,000 years. But my favourite one is the one you mentioned at the beginning, where the Queen Mum writes to a friend of hers during the war who's recently lost a relative, and she's very sympathetic and says, oh God, the war, it is awful, and I still jump when a bomb drops sort of near me, and then she signs off and says, tinkety-tonk, old fruit, and down with the Nazis. And I think that's my favourite single line in the whole book.
In addition to the the letters themselves, you also talk a bit in the book about the evolution of paper, the cost of paper, the cost of production, the cost of transporting, all these things. Has it just been a natural evolution then of the way letter writing is going?
Yeah, I mean, the classic thing is, it used to be only in the main, if we look at the golden age of letter writing, when it really began in the way that we know now, which was, sort of, as you said at the beginning, it's sort of the Renaissance. So letters existed a long time before then, but in terms of the correspondence that we understand now, you go back 500 or 600 years. And there is a natural evolution. So it used to be people who were extremely well-educated, who could both write and also afford to write and afford to send post, and often they had their own private mail carriers. And then through the line, it's become sort of cheaper and more accessible, and more people are writing. And obviously the penny post in 1840 made huge transformation. A lot of people felt that, letter writing was dying out then, because then everybody could write. And, so the kind of the snobs felt, in a very elitist way, oh God, this is going to be awful. And obviously right up to now and kind of emails and texts, where it's all obviously free and cheap.
One more curiosity from your book. Who wrote the shortest letter?
It's a fantastic letter where it was a writer writing to his publisher, saying, just inquiring about sales of their book. And they wrote, just all they sent was a question mark. And the publisher wrote back and just sent an exclamation mark. Just to show, obviously, that, you know, I'm sure it's clear, but just to show that sales were great.
So. Simon Garfield, author of To the Letter, Tales from a Vanishing World, thank you very much for joining us in the studio.
Absolute pleasure.
And in just a moment, we're going to be flicking through this morning's Brazilian front pages with Fernando Augusto Pacheco. But to get us there, this is Marcos Valle with Estrela. That was Marcos Valle there with Estrela.
You are listening to Midori House with me, Marcos Ippian Filhan. Time now to leaf through the morning's Brazilian front pages with Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Good morning, Fernando.
Good morning, Marcos. Program. Good morning, Phil.
Shall we start with Argentinian election results?
Let's start. Usually talk about Brazilian stories, but you know, in Brazil we cover Latin American stories as well. So today on Folha de São Paulo, I mean, we know a little bit about the results of the midterm elections in Argentina that happened yesterday. And it was a bad defeat for President Cristina Kirchner. I mean, she kept her majority in Congress, but just by a thin margin. But like in the main districts in the country, mainly Buenos Aires, the opposition leader Sergio Massa, who actually used to work in her government, he is far ahead of the Kirchner candidate that she chose for Buenos Aires. And it's interesting to note, Marcos, because, and you know, that she wanted to be candidate for re-election in 2015. Mm. But I don't think this would be possible anymore because, I mean, her party probably should go like around 30% in Congress and she would need at least two-thirds of the Congress to get this law voted.
Now, what were the main issues for Argentinians in their rejection, I guess, of Cristina Kirchner?
Well, I think the economy is not doing very well. I mean, since the Kirchners got into power, actually Argentina improved somehow the poverty levels, the economy, especially because before there was a huge crisis there. But I think in the last year, not so much, especially they're quite behind when you compare to other Latin American countries. So, yeah, I think there's been many, many issues. And Cristina is not doing very well at the moment.
And then moving on to Brazil. Fernando, what's the thing about all the polemic about non-authorized biographies?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny how Brazil can be... I mean, there's been this story going on the press. It started with a singer called Chico Buarque and Caetano Veloso that they were actually... They didn't want their non-authorized biographies to be published. And they managed for them not to be published.
How did they manage to do that?
Well, because our law in Brazil is very kind of, we have quite a lot of censorship in this aspect, you know, so that's why the government actually is trying to create a new law, I mean, for a debate on the publication of non-authorized biographies. Because, you know, basically, if I'm going to publish like a biography of you or Phil, whatever.
Without asking my permission.
Hmm? Yeah, and you can go to court and say, no, actually, I don't want this to be published. And you're probably going to win. So, and then today on Folha de São Paulo, our most famous singer, Roberto Carlos, is like the Brazilian Elvis Presley or something like that. He didn't want his biography to be published in 2007, but now he's saying that actually there must be a debate and actually maybe he was not right at the time. So maybe if the biography would be published now, he would probably say it's okay.
And this debate entered onto the front pages, the front cover of the country's best-selling magazine as well, Veja. What sides are people kind of taking on this issue? Are the media or journalists, are they on one side versus, you know, celebrities or well-known individuals?
Yeah, I think, of course, like Veja, you know, in their cover, they were quite critical about those artists who didn't want the biographies to be published. They said it's a question of freedom of expression. So, yeah, it's been a battle between journalists and artists somehow. Of course, the journalists want to publish, you know, the non-authorized biographies and the artists not really. Mm. So
one more story, Folha de São Paulo. There's a story
saying that, interesting numbers, since 1997, as many as 595 new cities were created in Brazil. What kind of places are those?
It's including cities like Fernando Falcão. I love this name.
You have a city named after you.
I would love to live in Fernando Falcão. And there's another cities called Maragi. So basically, they did a big feature on those new cities that were created since 97. And in their analysis, they actually see that the majority of those cities, they have lower quality of life standards when you compare to the average of the country. And that's true because it's kind of easy to create a new city in Brazil. You know, you don't need to, there's not so much bureaucracy to do that. And sometimes, I don't know exactly how it works, this process, but it's quite, sometimes it's for political reasons, you know. There's a special name in English, like when you want to change the map a little bit for a political party to win. But I think the government is going to vote later this year to regulate on the creation of a new city. So I hope so, because, I mean, Brazil have almost 6,000 cities.
And is it just they have to kind of hit a minimum population mark and then it suddenly becomes a city?
Exactly. And it's funny, even if you have like only 3,000 people, you can be a city. You can have a city status, you know, as much as São Paulo and Rio, which have like 6 or 7 million. So it's not like in Europe where there's a difference between city and villages. Mm. Not really. This little thing of 3,000 people, it is a city.
Shall we finish by talking about fashion?
Oh, yeah.
São Paulo Fashion Week starts today. Are we going to be seeing a lot of bikinis and speedos?
No, that's the sad thing. Today it's the autumn-winter collections, and most of the beachwear collections, which are very popular in Brazil, they only show during summer. But to be honest, our winter is not that cold. I think they should still show it. But, you know, I'm excited. You know, São Paulo Fashion Week is the fifth most important fashion week in the world, according to many fashion experts. And today there will be interesting shows on the catwalk, like Oskling, which is an interesting Brazilian brand that managed to, they have shops in Milan, they have shops in Tokyo, in Miami. So it's interesting to see that some Brazilian brands are going there, like to other countries.
And another very famous person will soon be walking up and down that catwalk as well.
Yeah, I mean, everybody's talking about that. Gisele is back on the catwalk. Gisele Bündchen is our most famous top model and the most well-paid top model in the world as well. She hasn't been on São Paulo Fashion Week since 2011. And now she's back. So all the photographers are there waiting.
And is it just because it's, you know, more importance to São Paulo Fashion Week? It's just growing and growing?
Yeah, I think it's growing. It's on the 7th year now. And 17th year. So yeah, I think it's growing and it's doing. And we have Fashion Rio as well, which is going to start like in about 2 weeks' time, which is becoming quite important as well. Not quite as important as São Paulo Fashion Week, but you know, it's an importance as well.
It sounds like São Paulo would indeed be the place to be this week. That was Monaco's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Thank you as ever for joining us.
Unfortunately, that is all the time we have for today's program. Thanks to our producer, Daphne Denis, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Alex Funnell. Up next after the news is The Urbanist. Stay tuned for the briefing at midday in London. That's 7 o'clock in the morning in New York City. I'll be back with Dominic Reynolds for Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Marco Sippi. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness to words that moved nations. It's dead men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time, it tells history. Rolex.